This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The Ku Klux Klan is planning a rally in Harmony, North Carolina tomorrow. They publicized this through a flyer that was reprinted on the front page of the Statesville Record and Landmark as news. The editorial board of the paper explained the decision with an impassioned editorial that included this statement: "The Ku Klux Klan is one of our nation's oldest and most violent hate groups. Its members preach a message of ignorance and discrimination that targets so many people in our community. We will not ignore it, and we will not shelter our readers from the discomfort of having to confront racism in their midst." Well, hate groups like the Ku Klux Klan generate a powerful emotional reaction. Their rallies can draw large crowds of angry protesters who try to shout down their opponents. David Lamott believes there's another approach that uses creative nonviolence. David found evidence of this third way 5 years ago at a Klan rally in Knoxville, Tennessee. A group called the Ku Klux Clowns went to that rally, and they turned the event upside down. Lamott was so moved by the incident, he wrote a poem that's been illustrated and published as a children's book. The book is called White Flower. Author David Lamott is with me now. David, welcome. Good to have you here.
Such a pleasure.
Actually, good to have you back. So tell us about this rally and what happened in Knoxville.
Yeah, so in 2007, May 26th, in fact, we're coming up on the five-year anniversary tomorrow. In 2007, there was this neo-Nazi and Klan rally in Knoxville, and they were protesting a murder that had happened there. There was a black-on-white murder, apparently, and they apparently were angry that the defendants had not been lynched. You know, they felt like they had been coddled by the authorities. And so they had this rally in Knoxville. And the folks who decided to come out and protest came up with a quite creative way, an effective way, to respond. What they did was they dressed in full clown regalia, they rehearsed quite carefully, and then they went to the march. And when the Klan started their chants of white power, the clowns all kind of leaned in and listened like they couldn't quite get what they were saying. And they said, "Oh, now I see what this rally is for. I was confused, but I see what it is. This is a rally for white flour. What a great idea." And so they pulled out bags of flour and they started throwing them at each other, had a big flour fight, and sort of had a lot of fun with this, effectively refusing to take these silly ideas seriously. And they turned the energy of the rally and refused to give the Klan what they came for, which was rage and hatred and and violence in the face of violence.
What happened at that rally in terms of spectators, the coverage? What did the Klan and the Nazis do?
Yeah, it went on from there. You know, the clowns continued to evolve through several layers of street theater and humor on this. But what the response was that one of the Klan guys got really angry and ran at, I'm sure several of them got angry, but one of them ran at the clowns and was arrested. But other than that, there were no incidents of violence at the rally. And the Klan, actually, an hour and a half before they were scheduled to leave, packed up and went home.
You know, this is why Wavy Gravy dressed up like a clown. Before he got the clown outfit, he was getting beaten at rallies all the time and protesting. He finally realized it looks really bad when you beat a clown.
Yeah, it's bad for him. You just shouldn't beat up clowns.
A clown.
Right.
Although
right.
He did take a few beatings after that anyway.
I'm sure.
Tell me a little bit more about the group themselves. Were they an ad hoc group or were they already organized around this idea?
A bit of each. They were an ad hoc group at first. They've continued to meet. They're still in effect. Following up on your last story tangentially, as a group called the Clean Coal Clowns in Tennessee. And so they're continuing to doing this work, but this was one of the early iterations of the group. And they were drawn largely from a group called Mountain Justice in eastern Tennessee that's an environmental group.
And what about your involvement then? When did you hear about it, and why did you decide to write a poem?
So I was not at the rally. I wasn't there, but I got an email a couple of weeks later from a friend of mine who had seen an independent article about this in indie media. And I was just so taken by the story, as my friend knew I would be, so that's why she sent it. And I was just kind of smitten by not only the humor of it and the creativity of it, but the effectiveness of it. And it really illustrates this idea of a third way, that fight and flight are built so deeply into us, but often are not the best options we have if we can be a little more creative and get past those ideas. And so I kind of carried this around in my pocket for a few weeks while I was on tour, and then ended up writing it into a poem. I was out doing shows in Florida, and I had a day off between shows, booked myself into a hotel, and just spent the whole day writing this poem. Started performing it at concerts, and people were responding really powerfully to it. So after a couple of years of that, it became clear that I needed to make a children's book.
And then what about the illustrations? Tell us how your poem came together with an illustrator, and this came to be a book.
Well, I had talked with a couple of different illustrators before I found Jen Hales, and for one reason or another, it didn't work. But a dear friend of mine connected me with Jen, pointed me to her website, and when I saw her art, I was just knocked out. She does work that has this certain melancholy in it, but also has whimsy and humor. And it's really hard to combine humor and serious topics. You know, Lyle Lovett does that well, but there aren't many songwriters who can pull it off. John Gorka can. And I think Jen really does that in her art. And that's what this story calls for. It's a very serious topic. It's quite disturbing. At the same time, it's very funny. And to be able to pull that off and not have the humor defeat the seriousness,
yeah,
or the other way around, is really it's really fine art.
Will you read for us?
I'd be delighted. This is picking up kind of toward the end of the poem and book. "White power," came the mad refrain, quite carefully pronounced. The clowns consulted once again, and then a woman clown announced, "I've got it. I'm embarrassed that it took so long to see, but what these marchers march for is a cause quite dear to me." "Wife power," she exclaimed, and all the other clowns joined in. They shook their heads and laughed at how erroneous they'd been. The women clowns were hoisted up on shoulders of the others. Some pulled on wedding dresses, chanting, "Here's to wives and mothers." Now the men in robes were sullen. They knew they'd been defeated. They yelled a few more times, and then they finally retreated. And when they'd gone, a kind policeman turned to all the clowns, and he offered them an escort through the center of the town. The day was bright and sunny, as most May days tend to be, in the hills of Appalachia down in Knoxville, Tennessee. People joined the new parade. The crowd stretched out for miles. The clowns passed out more flowers and made everybody smile. And what would be the lesson of this shiny southern day? Can we understand the message that the clown sought to convey? It seems that when you're fighting hatred, hatred's not the thing to use. So here's to those who march on in their big red floppy shoes.
David Lamotte reading from his newly published children's book, White Flower. It is farce, of course, and that's what makes it genius. Kids love that sort of thing, the mishearing. You know, it's, no, well, wife, right, power, you mean. And the,
right,
kids say, no. I,
right,
mean, is that, but essentially, and what you're saying is what we're doing is pointing to the humor, the farce that's embedded in the initial message, in the message of hate.
Right.
There's where the farce is.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And to turn that back and refuse to take it seriously is one creative approach. And it actually worked quite well that particular day. Now, I wouldn't suggest that dressing up as clowns is always the best way to respond to this kind of aggression. But I would suggest that creativity that allows us to look beyond fight and flight is always.
Well, let's talk about when that's appropriate and when it's not, because we can now tee off on the Klan. I mean, it's kind of interesting that we have to. If this had been 1960, we would actually have to give equal time to the Klan, if you can imagine.
Right.
That.
Yeah. Right?
Imagine that. And then somebody would come up and say, well, what about the other side? Said, there is no other side. And hate and discrimination, there's no other side. We've got a few issues before us this day that hopefully 10 years down the line, we won't have to be giving equal time to hate and discrimination.
Yes.
We still have to play the game for a moment. But that's the question. Is this appropriate in all situations? So many complaints about the level of discourse and the amount of polarity in our public discussion these days. Can we apply ourselves this way in all of our protest against what we think is wrong?
No. I think actually different situations call for different approaches entirely. And my work around peacemaking issues and around mediation and such, this is not mediation, this work. This is social justice work. This is naming something as wrong and standing against it. And that's a very different kind of approach to listening to both sides and hearing people out. And I think that work is also important. If I had the opportunity to meet with one of these guys one-on-one, I would listen to the rant and the rage, and I would question it, and I would try to be compassionate enough to turn people, because generally you don't turn people by shouting at them, right?
Or by mocking them.
But to be clear, I think what the clowns were doing that day, they weren't actually mocking the Klan. They were mocking the things the Klan was saying. That's a subtle but important distinction. And I think it's important, the spirit that that's done in as well. I come up with some stupid ideas from time to time, and I'm really grateful that my wife and my friends will tease me a little bit and say, Dave, you know what you're saying there? That's silly. and so I think that kind of approach can be really productive and can be offered in love.
Are there third way, creative nonviolent approaches that can help us get to a better form of mediation, a better way of having the dialogue when there are contentious issues and people of good conscience on both sides simply can't agree?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, a situation like this one, the tension runs so high, the emotions are dominant over any ideas. And so the first thing you have to do is deal with the emotions. And humor has an amazing capacity to disperse rage. And it really seems to have worked that way to a great degree that day. People, you know, I'm not sure the Klan was entirely amused, but they were kind of deflated from their rage, apparently, from what I've seen and read. And I've talked extensively with folks who were there that day, including some of the main organizers. And I think this was effective that day, and it's a fascinating story to hold up as an example, to examine and see to what degree it applies and how inspirational it might be.
What are you hoping kids take away? Because it's unclear these days whether or not the average, you know, fourth or fifth grader has a very deep understanding of what the Klan was or a deep knowledge of the Klan.
Right, right. We are shooting this book toward fourth and fifth graders, sort of middle school, at the point where they have encountered a bit of civil rights history. And there's a curriculum being drawn up, actually, in Texas to go with this book for kids that age. And one of the things that they're suggesting is that they show a bit of To Kill a Mockingbird before they have this discussion. But what I'm really hoping that kids are going to take away from this is to go beyond what Walter Wink called the myth of redemptive violence. You know, most of our entertainment and most of our moral stories that we're throwing out there, the storyline is basically that the solution to a problem is when the good guys effectively beat up the bad guys. And I think we can do better than that. The truth is, you know, when that happens in a movie, the movie ends right there. Yeah. And we don't see all of the repercussions of that violence. And I think if we're going to survive, we need to examine some possibilities of responding to violence that don't include violence.
Well, you know, the narrative of the Great War, right, is that violence was necessary to end what was a greater ill. Of course, we never tell the part of the narrative that says, and because it was a violent solution, it led to decades of even more violence and millions of people being displaced and murdered pretty much under the same circumstances because the violent conclusion sent a message that only violence wins and only strength counts in this new world created by this new order.
Mm-hmm.
Are we doing a good enough job telling that story? Because, again, the end of the Great War narrative isn't told. The Slobodan Milosevic is a great example of a dictator brought down by street theater. It started with college kids doing street theater,
sure,
and a guy with the army and all the tanks, and not a shot was fired, and he's forced out of office within a year and a half of the street theater beginning. And so few people know about that.
Right. And Václav Havel that used art in the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. There are tons of examples of that. And I would say absolutely not. We are not doing a good enough job of telling these stories, and we need to be doing a better job of it. The Howard Zinn Project is doing a good job of putting some materials out there. If we can spread the word about that and point people toward it. These stories are important, and they need to be told, and we need to be redefining the narrative a little bit.
You used a Kickstarter campaign to fund this book. Tell us how that went.
Oh, my goodness. What an affirming process. It was amazing. We set out to raise $18,500 to print 2,500 copies of the book. And we were going to take the entire month of March to do that and end that campaign on April 1st, on April Fool's Day, seemed appropriate. So 12 days into that project, we hit our goal, raised the $18,500 after 12 days. The buzz was just kind of overwhelming. People were kind of shooting it around to all of their friends and saying, this is important. I want to be a part of this. I just funded it. You should too. And so it became clear that we really needed to up our goal. And so we took the initial print run from 2,500 to 10,000, printed 10,000 copies of the book to start off with, and ended the month with 204% of our initial goal, about $38,000. And so that enabled us not only to print more books, but also to hire a good publicity firm. So doing some TV down in Atlanta next week, and delighted to be here with you today and getting the word out there.
Yeah. Is this where the Third Way, you think, is perhaps got its greatest life? Got him, yeah. And off the radar in that virtual world where people are spreading the word among themselves and bypassing guys like me.
Well, I think I don't want to bypass people like you. I so tremendously value your voice in the community. But in addition to guys like you, it is – there's no question that the grassroots – the power of grassroots we're seeing unfold in ways that we haven't in a very long time, since before all the technology.
Well, and it's allowing for a lot more artistic expression that may not find its way. You know, if you can't find somebody to publish your book and you're a good writer, you can get it out there. And as your campaign, I think, shows, you've got a good book and you go 204% of your goal because you got it out to the folks.
Yeah, it's been extremely affirming. The book actually officially comes out tomorrow. And we've already sold nearly 1,000 copies.
Mm-hmm. So. Hey, you were selected as a Rotary Peace Fellow in 2008.
Tell us
about that experience.
It was a tremendous honor. Rotary has this extraordinary program they started in 2002, celebrating its 10th year now. And they choose 60 people worldwide from applicants, send 10 each to one of six Rotary Peace Centers around the world. And you're not allowed to study in your own country, so I was not eligible to study at the center that happens to be located here as a cooperative program between UNC and Duke, which I always tell people is already peacemaking. So I studied in Australia at the University of Queensland and did fieldwork in India, in South India, with a Gandhian organization there for 3 months. And all of that was paid for by Rotary. It was an extraordinary opportunity. And if anybody wants to know more about that, please contact me, because I'm a big booster of that program.
Well, we'll tell everybody how they can do that in just a minute or two. But I want to talk to you about your musician's life as well, and how much of this peacemaking and Third Way, the idea of art as a kind of bridge in this public discourse, how much of that makes its way into your music?
There's no question that art speaks to us in ways that words alone can't. Even artful words, I guess, are art. But it's a powerful way to connect people. Or actually, I would say, to remind us of our connectedness. However, I'm an activist and I'm a musician, but I'm not really an activist musician. It's an interesting thing. I like to raise questions in my songs more than I like to offer answers. And I like to invite people into thinking about some things. But I think that a good concert should be like a good conversation. There should be some part of it that's completely light and you naturally, in a conversation, when things get heavy, we naturally find a way to laugh. And it's the same way in a good concert. I don't want to just bum people out and talk about issues all night, you know. Yeah. I want to invite them into a deeper sense of community and talk about some things that matter and also laugh a little.
Well, it's the opening up. I think that's what art can do. The artistic rendition of anything opens you to your own possibilities, all of the ideas you may have been blocking from yourself. So it's not me imposing my idea through my cleverly crafted song. It's me opening you up to your own clever ideas that I could never have imagined.
Yes. The best art isn't instructive. It's evocative.
Beautiful. David, what a pleasure to have you on the show.
Delight. Thank you for your hospitality.
David Lamont, singer-songwriter, author of White Flower, a poetic account of a Klan rally that took place in Knoxville, Tennessee, 5 years ago tomorrow. Klan has planned another rally for tomorrow, this time at Harmony, North Carolina. You'll have to check with the Klan to find out more about that. But you can find out about David's book at his website, davidlamotte.com, and Lamotte is spelled L-A-M-O-T-T-E, davidlamotte.com. Coming up after a short break, Jewel Brown live in the studio on The State of Things. Stay with us.